Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Avengers Endgame, Captain Marvel, and a little bit of Hellboy. If we can get to it in our half-hour format.
Let's start with some consumer advice. If you go to see Avengers Endgame, do not have any liquids whatsoever before seeing the film, because you really want to sit it through. And it sounds like I'm joking there, but it's serious, actually. If you really, you don't want to walk out, because there's a lot going on in this film, and there's so many superheroes who pop up. If you step out to use the restroom, even for just 30 seconds, you're going to miss one of your favorite superheroes, because some of them fly through very quickly. So act like a monk or something going in for for a prayer session. Just, you know, abstain from liquids in particular.
Yes. I mean, food, too, but mostly liquids. Yeah, there are 19 Academy Award nominated actors in this movie, and some of them are only there for a second or two.
This is embarrassing, but it was only when I read the end credits that I saw some names, and I thought, well, where was he? Where was she? And I realized how quickly some of them pop up. Of course, a lot of them have, you know, heavy, what I call heavy costuming and makeup and so on. It's not exactly the usual glamour shots, but it's overloaded. It's overstuffed in all kinds of ways. And after all, it has a running time of 181 minutes.
It's like a Bollywood film.
That's 3 hours. I mean, if they could have at least kept it a little under 3 hours, that's that extra minute that gets to me. If they could have kept it 179 or something. But it really is verging on that kind of epic. And actually, you know, in the U.S., it's been showing straight through, so you have to, like, bolt yourself to the seat. Internationally, in many countries, they've decided, if not nation by nation, at least theater chain by theater chain, that they would insert an intermission. And the way they've handled it in some countries is totally arbitrary, almost just like at the 90-minute mark. They were just, you know, in the middle of a scene practically, like Thor raises his hammer. And then they suddenly, they did actually, they were just cut into it. And then the audience would have those 3 to 5 minutes for you know, creature needs, and then come back for the remaining 90 minutes. So it's really testing the limits in a lot of ways, because you'd have to almost go back to the real epics, you know, Gone with the Wind and Cleopatra type films, where you're into the 3 to 4 hour range where you need to think about an intermission. I think it's at about the most you can have it without an intermission. If it were like 3.5 hours, and it's partly the matter of franchise bloat, if you will, because the previous installment, you know, Infinity War had a running time of 160 minutes. And this one, of course, is 181 minutes. So it's as if it's, and I have very mixed negative feelings in this respect, but it's that Hollywood maxim that more is better. And so however many superheroes appear in one film, you'll do the math and have even more in the next. And the running time correspondingly goes on. And even if you like the film, it can be both exhaustive and exhausting.
Well, the fact that it's sort of a recap and like finishes up the thread for a lot of characters, you almost have to give everybody a few minutes. But that's why you can't get up, because, you know, while you're watching, you're like, wait a minute, is that Natalie Portman? And then she's gone.
Yeah, and then she's
wait,
gone.
Wait, was that Robert Redford? And then he's gone.
I know, he was gone so quickly. I was almost like shocked to see him there. Like,
you know, what are you doing
wrong,
there?
The wrong movie set. You know, he was lost at sea and then pops up here. It's really discombobulating. And again, on the mixed negative side there, some of them, there's a sense of a checklist that you've got to have them all appear. But some of them, they're flying through literally so quickly that it holds your attention, but in the sense of, oh, there's so-and-so, and it's kind of distracting and extremely superficial in that respect. It seems obligatory that certain people must pop up, and then they're gone.
Actually, I felt like it was more like being at a party where there's a whole lot of people, and you don't see everybody at once, but they've all got to be there. You know, I mean, you do want to, since it's supposed to be, you know, the sort of a finale of sorts, you know, you have to pay homage to all the things that got you there.
It is a huge costume party.
It is a huge costume party.
Absolutely. Well, we should talk about it as financial reporters as much as film critics, because we're talking about it as we tape just after the opening weekend, and it was a massive turnout. Here you have a film that grossed $1.2 billion worldwide. And in the U.S. alone, the figure that struck me was $350 million domestic. That is the production budget, you know, $350 million. It made back its budget the opening weekend. Now, you have to factor in also that they spent $150 million on marketing. But you realize within a matter of a few days, this film will have made back what it costs to make it. And at that point, you start sailing into complete profits. We're going to have a lot more billionaires in this country because of this. Now, the previous film, Infinity War, did a total of $2 billion. That's the cumulative This film will be surpassing that in no time at all. And it's going to be on the very short list of top grossing films of all time. It could actually go to the top if people keep turning out like this. I mean, all of us who saw it on the opening weekend had to strategize as to when we'd mm-hmm. get in to see the film. I ended up in a front row seat because it was the only thing left, and my neck shall never recover. And so it really, I did not see it in 3D, but I felt as if I had. It was that immersive because it totally filled my visual field, which again was a mixed blessing because I felt sort of bruised and battered by the end of it.
I know what you mean about the 3D. I wanted to see it in 3D. In fact, I actually had three different tickets, and I was trying to make something work out. And I thought, I was really concerned about seeing the 3D one because it was at a theater that doesn't have a reserved seat. I thought, how soon do you have to get there to not end up in the front row like that? Because that would have just killed it. So I ended up seeing it in a place with stadium seating and the night seats that you could reserve. But there were so many showings of this film. I mean, 4 o'clock in the morning, midnight.
Well, there were theater chains nationally that were showing it round the clock, absolutely. And the megaplexes would have it on so many screens that it was almost by the half hour as to when you entered. Because that's a challenge from an exhibitor's standpoint, is that when you have a film that runs over 3 hours, and then just getting people in and out, that, you know, in terms of the number of shows you can have in a day even. So that's what's really all the more impressive, is just how many screenings there were. And the only way you can do that, finally, I saw it at 9:30 in the morning on a Sunday. It was my church going for the season. But, you know, when you mentioned you had bought 3 tickets for it?
Well, I cashed in the other 2. I mean, I had done them online.
Because you account for a lot of the $1.2 billion then. You're ticket buying.
Well, you know, more than the ticket buying, I wonder how the concessions did, because they must have just been cranking out popcorn and candy for 24 hours.
Well, it was sort of like the fallout shelter mentality. You know, when mm-hmm. you go into the fallout shelter, you better have some food with you. So people really, I noticed that a lot of people really had stocked up. They were eating for the day, basically. No, it's true. I mean, I saw it at a Cinebistro, so people literally were eating. But it's as if they had stocked up for the day there. But in terms of franchise filmmaking, again, this is something where mega becomes even more mega. Everything keeps accelerating that way. So nowadays, you know, Disney/Marvel pretty much own the universe. I mean, they control everything. And I smiled when I heard somebody refer to that domination as the time-money continuum. Because
time-money continuum?
Yes, because in effect, this is the new cinematic universe. And I'll give you an example of why I think that's at best a mixed blessing. With this enormous popularity for superhero movies, and I'll admit I'm not a fanboy, so I'm working against that or cutting against it. But one reason I cut against it is, even if you like those superhero movies a lot, there's so many out there and they're so dominant that if you go to the multiplex, what are your choices? Well, you can watch Avengers at 3:34, 4:35, and other movies get squeezed out. That's one thing there. Another is what's happening in film production is, it's getting really polarized now. You either have the big, what used to be called tentpole pictures, the really big, spectacular films like this, CGI reliant and so on, that cost $350 million to make. My goodness. You have the pictures at that end, which are, you know, really dominating the marketplace. And then at the far other end, you have the really small independent films. What's dropped out, not completely, but increasingly, are the movies in the middle. A medium-sized budget, maybe interesting as an adult subject matter, those are increasingly hard-pressed to make money. And it's not a healthy scenario when you have really enormously popular films like Avengers at one end and then the small indie favorites, the critical favorites, at the other end, and not as much of that middle. And it doesn't have to be middle brow, but just movies in the middle that way. I'll give you an example from my weekend when I was watching a lot of films, including Avengers. In Avengers, the character Valkyrie is played by Tessa Thompson. And so she's part of the biggest movie, maybe the biggest movie ever by the time all is said and done. The same weekend, I went to see her in a small independent film called Little Woods, and I saw it at the Parkway Theater in Baltimore City. I was the only person in the auditorium, and I appreciated having a private screening in some ways. I could stretch out there and watch it. I thought, my goodness, in the same weekend, I saw her in one movie where I got just about the last seat in the house, and then I saw her in another movie where I had, you know, the whole place to myself. And you know, good for her that she's in both a big movie and a small movie, but you see what I'm getting at there. When the middle drops out, that's bad in the business sense, Because when you're not making a lot of money from something like Avengers, what about the weeks, you know, some weeks down the road where you're kind of scraping because you don't have a superhero movie at the moment? You'll have one in no time at all, but at the moment you don't. And the really small pictures get marginalized so much they're really just art house fare. And that middle picture that used to be what would keep a theater going week to week to week, those movies are still being made to some extent, but they're not particularly pulling the public as much because people think, well, I'll wait till I can stream it or whatever, you know. And so when you think about the overall marketplace, it's not an entirely good scenario.
I think, though, the movies like The Avengers, there's a mob mentality to it. Like, you really can't compete with a movie like Gloria Bell, for example. But that's not necessarily a movie you want to see with everybody as part of this big event.
I know, but I don't want to be alone when I'm watching it. I do enjoy being around other people sometimes.
Very, very good point. The blockbuster nature of something like Avengers, I think, would have gotten these numbers. But how much do you think people coming out had to do with the fact that this won't be streamed, that you're going to have Disney Plus to be able to see it?
That's an important part of it. Increasingly, the theaters are so worried, as they should be, about streaming and also about the exhibition windows that they've enjoyed for so long. For most of recent film history, there has been what's called a 90-day window. For instance, that a movie would be first run in the theater and it would be a minimum of 90 days before it could go to any ancillary or secondary market, which nowadays mostly means streaming since, you know, the second run movie theaters are more or less extinct. Netflix is the quote-unquote villain here more than any other, and I don't want to get too sidetracked with it, but the fact that when they started not just distributing films but producing them and then having them exhibited time and date the same for theaters and streaming, or just a week or two between, exhibitors, the traditional movie theater chains, understandably are really worried about that. And that's still playing out. It's kind of hard. I can see where it's headed, but it's hard to say decisively how that will be settled. But in the case of something like this, Disney is absolutely brilliant with marketing and with control, and it's always been that way. Years ago, I used to talk to theater owners about the different film companies they dealt with, and I mean the major movie studios. And they always said, you know, there's this public image of Walt Disney being all smiles and you know, happy children. But as a company, it was the most cutthroat, and cutthroat in the sense of a very, very smartly run organization, and everything had to be on its terms. And I remember years ago an exhibitor telling me that, you know, most theater chains, when they're dealing with the studios, would operate on what was called a sliding scale. In other words, the weekend the movie opened, a certain percentage of the money went to the studio, a certain percentage went to the theater owner. And the sliding scale was, and that opening weekend, for instance, almost all the money went to the distributor, meaning the studio. And so the theaters changed at that point, made their money off of concessions because, you know, people do have to eat popcorn. And so that's where you made your money, particularly the first or second week. If a movie held on longer, if it had legs, several weeks into it, the sliding scale was that more of the money at that point would be in the theater's pocket, less in the distributors. There's not as much money coming in at that point, but more of it stays with the theater. Disney, from what I was told years ago, oftentimes was adamant in saying that it would get a really high percentage of the gross, and that would be the case. And you couldn't really fight with them very much because when it was a big Disney picture, you know, animated picture, you want it, and you're going to play by Disney's terms. So Disney / Marvel really does sort of own the universe in that respect. And in terms of some of the numbers we're talking about here, that this really is a market they control totally. And so if you have to go to the theater, you won't be streaming it at home. You'll be streaming on your way to the theater. In other words, you will be streaming as you head to the theater. But in terms of the numbers, look at this Avengers franchise. The film we're talking about is the 22nd in a series that goes back 11 years with the Iron Man. Mm-hmm. And by now, the whole generation of people have grown up with this. And, you know, I don't want to make it seem like mob mentality or you know, drones heading to the theater. No, that would be so insulting. I don't mean it really that way so much as the fact that the movie marketplace has morphed in such a way that these are the dominant players. This is what people go to. When people leave the sofa, when they leave the streaming devices, this is what will get them out the door into the theater. So push come to shove, I'm not happy with that in creative terms and in aesthetic terms generally and financially either. But you know what? I want people to go to the movie theater. And if this fills the seats, I want to keep the movie theaters going so that when I go, like, you know, to see some other movie, I can have the place to myself.
Well, I'm just going to go out and say that a 22-movie box set is going to be quite the undertaking if they're going to release it at all?
Well, you know, to play off of that, even though this is ostensibly the final installment, endgame after all, it sort of, sort of indicates that it might be. And since some of the superheroes don't make it out alive, and I would never spoil it, by now people probably know, but I would never spoil it into who makes it, who doesn't, or who makes it and is the worse for wear. There are a few of those as well. The thing is, like, with the way this is set up, I can safely say that Guardians of the Galaxy is safe for future installments, and any number of other superheroes all still have multiple opportunities because there's a lot of cross-fertilization in this genre now.
You can also have Son of.
Well, or daughter of. Daughter of, increasingly, because it's increasingly the female protagonist, you know. And that's actually something that comes through in this final installment, is that when you see all of the superheroes lined up at the end, basically, how many of them are women at this point, which you would not have seen in superhero movies to any great extent, you know, even just, what, 5-10 years ago.
You know, without getting into who makes and who doesn't make it, it is satisfying to have some closure. Because after 22 movies, I mean, my God, you just think this is just never ending. And it's something that I find a little annoying about TV shows. You watch a show, it's really good. And then they had an arc, but they decide to extend it indefinitely. The character's story gets bigger and bigger, like Lost. And then they can never kind of bring it to a close, and then they decide to cancel the show, and then they just leave you hanging.
Well, this is a very cynical observation, so I'll make it. It seems to me that there is closure in the sense of certain characters have been bumped off or put into old age, if you will. And I'm not going to spoil it.
Put up the pasture.
But yeah, exactly. But you know what? But some of the actors had declared that they were finished. They were done with it. It's almost like with the James Bond thing. You know, if your James Bond says, I'm not making anymore, you start to make arrangements. And here, in some ways, they're sort of handing on the shield. You know, things are being passed along in a way because sometimes the actors have declared. Now, you know, it's the never say never syndrome if they offer you enough money. But a few of the actors had made it clear they didn't want to go on doing this. So at that point, it makes sense, as in serial television, to write out the character, write it off one way or the other. But so the cynicism is not even that so much because, you know, people want out, so they're written out, so much as we still have more than a dozen superheroes who are still very much alive and kicking, literally, by the end of this. And even though Avengers per se may not remain together as a team, there's so many members of it who can join up in various configurations. You almost need to start doing algorithms here as to, like, how many possible superhero movies can spin off of this one. So we ain't seen the end of it by any means.
Well, but we have seen at least a pause.
Well, for a few seconds, maybe.
Well,
but
I'll take it, though.
I mean, you know, it used to be this kind of superhero film, or in fact, what I'm calling tentpole pictures. Those were your big holiday releases, particularly summertime. And now that's become year-round.
Well, you know, we don't have Stan Lee anymore. So whatever comes next is...
Yeah, but you know what? But when Stan Lee died, and I'm thinking about Carrie Fisher in the same respect, mm-hmm. they always have footage. They you know, so there's some archive with footage, mm-hmm. outtakes, if you will. And I think like 10 years from now, somehow her specter will still be there, or Stan Lee, at least for a few frames, will pop up. And they never go away. You know, they're always with us.
Yeah, we'll still get the cameos, but we won't have those people actually being involved in the shows anymore. That's what we're giving up. By the way, I read that Robert Downey Jr. was the only cast member who read the entire film script, that everybody else was sort of kept in the dark and shot a couple of scenes so that nobody except for Robert Downey Jr. really knew what was going to happen.
See, and I think that works to Robert Downey Jr. gives a really good performance in this. He looks haggard. He looks his age. He's very much middle-aged, and he's been through a lot as a character. And I thought he did a really good job because it gives the film a little more gravitas. And what I liked about the film, I wasn't crazy about the film, but what I liked about it actually was the tonal balance. It manages to have some really serious moments, if anything, a little too somber. Some of them kind of drag out a bit, but it balances the serious scenes with outright silly ones and somehow makes it work. I thought the balance was struck there. So emotionally, I think that works. Structurally, doesn't always quite work because some of the dialogue scenes, especially the serious ones, are just dragged out too long. It's like I make a pompous statement and I pause and then you look at me soulfully and then we cut back and forth. You know what I mean? Some of those go on for like 5 minutes or so. And then after a sequence like that, it goes to this frenetically edited battle scene, mm-hmm. with the razor sharp editing. And I don't know who's doing what to whom and why. Some of it's a little too fast. And when you alternate scenes like that, structurally, visually, it's a little bumpy in places. However, emotionally, ironically, that it holds together in a way because you feel like you have had some serious time with these characters, and then they also will say and do something so goofy. And you know, in superhero movies, of course, there's always that sense that however serious a scene or however dangerous it is, there's always going to be that punchline or you know, leavening moment. But here it actually didn't seem glib. It seemed like it helped to keep things balanced, more or less.
How did you like Fat Thor?
what about?
Just beautiful Chris Hemsworth, just gone to seed.
Well, he really went. He was the dude at that point. He'd gone, you know, Big Lebowski. You know,
yes.
He certainly sported a gut there. I think, you know, with all the money he's made, he had a few brewskis. I actually like that about the film. I love some of the side profile shots where I thought, well, Lord, that's a gut. You know, like Jeff Bridges will be envious of this. You know, the dude abides for sure in this moment. But see, that's actually where the film has some welcome moments, that it shows a superhero who's sort of gone to pot a bit or to beer. And you know, and I kind of like that because you usually think like this is like usual, like pinup material, like totally buff and all. But you know what? You know, all these characters have been around long enough, not that they're quite middle-aged, but you know, you have a few extra beers and you get a gut like that, right? And then like joking aside, Robert Downey Jr. really looked haggard. He really, and he played that up actually, you know, the pocked face and just, you know, weight loss and whatever. Speaking, you know, so Hemsworth is putting on the weight. Downey Jr. looked like he'd been, you know, losing it in a way that he looked kind of emaciated. And I was actually sort of concerned for the character. He looks really ill in it. You know, he looks drawn, or at least if everything he's been through. He didn't seem like Iron Man anymore. He still had like the medallion on, but it seemed like a very mortal, very human Iron Man. And I like that about the film, that some of the characters were allowed to seem, you know, human by superhero standards, and mortality, if you will. And again, not give tipping, you know, hand as to who survives, who doesn't, but the fact that you saw they were vulnerable. And that actually enhances the dramatic conflict with Thanos, who's this bizarrely strong and almost, you know, invincible, as he'd say of himself, villain.
Inevitable,
right. And the fact that, you know, all of them together have trouble fighting him. And then when you realize that many of them are vulnerable, like with Captain America, I thought one of the really sort of heart-wrenching moments for me was when he's fighting Thanos and his shield gets like the half of it broken off sort of thing. I thought, you know, they really are suffering here. And it seemed like real blood and bruises. And even though it's like silly superhero stuff, I kind of, you know, thought about that, that, you know, that these are people, I didn't care about them as much as a fanboy would, but I did care about them.
You know, there were a lot of callbacks to things, not just Marvel movies. There was some Doctor Who stuff in there.
Yeah, there is, actually. I know.
Yeah, the know. Time Heist is the title of an episode in the 8th season.
Yeah.
And Karen Gillan, who plays Nebula, was Amy Pond in several seasons of Doctor Who. So you even get the Doctor Who folks in there.
Well, you know, when a movie runs 181 minutes, you can get a lot in there.
That's a good point.
And it's sort of a blender mentality. You just keep adding elements to the blender, you know? And more, again, it's the more is more and more is better mentality. You just keep adding to it. And that's some fun. It can be kind of exhausting, too, and superficial, but it's kind of fun to see all these things pop up.
And, you know, speaking of Carrie Fisher and Stan Lee sort of appearing, you know, even after they're gone, they did some digital de-aging to make Stan Lee look a little bit younger.
Yes, they did. Yes. You can do anything. I mean, after a while, you know, humans will be dispensable. We'll all just exist on a screen somehow. You can make us look younger, older, whatever you want.
Well, no, we'll all have our own Photoshop filter that appears in front of us.
I can't wait.
Yeah, me either. I'm looking for subtitles to appear with people as well.
Did you care about the story much here?
The actual story?
Yeah, there was one.
You know, I was really... It was like being at a party where you see a lot of your old friends from high school and you see what happened to some of them, and some of them look better and some of them look worse. That was my kind of take on it. Every time I saw a new character appear, like the crowd in my theater went crazy anytime anybody from Black Panther appeared.
Oh, they did. There was such a applause there. He'd win as president. You kidding?
I mean, yes.
It was wonderful to see the audience response on that. Yeah, there was genuine enthusiasm.
So I enjoyed that ebb and flow. I enjoyed some of the slick, sly things they put in there, like having the Hulk eating his own Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
That was funny,
actually. I mean, funny stuff.
That was
funny. You kind of had to pay attention.
But some of those are incidentals. I mean, the story itself. I mean, Thanos in Infinity War had killed off half the world population, right? So when he pops up again now, it's kind of a reprise in some ways of here he is and he's looking to, you know, kill all of humanity for reasons that are just best left to a supervillain, you know, as to why he wants to do this. But I found that I was just not indifferent, but just kind of marking time like, and I actually maybe somewhat indifferent as in, okay, well, you know, why are there six Infinity Stones, you know, and what's this glove of doom and what's all, and it's like, I know it's comic book material, but I was watching and thinking, well, okay, well, these look like, you know, like cheap rhinestones, that I costume jewelry that I could pick up, but somehow having all six of these means the world, literally,
yes.
Right? Means the world. And I won't say I was bored by that, but to me, it didn't seem like really compelling. It just seemed kind of arbitrary. And then as to various people wearing the glove and so on, I thought, well, it is sort of a costume party where you get to try in somebody else's outfit.
I liked a lot of things about the movie. I can't necessarily say I thought the plot was the strongest thing.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah, I know.
But I didn't think it really needed as much as just because it did have so many people to.
But see what
through.
I'm getting
like,
at
like
is
I enjoyed seeing Ant-Man, for example. Like I said, you know, it's like, oh, look, Ant-Man, because I saw that movie in Denmark. So it sort of brought back the time and place of when I'd seen that other movie.
Well, we all do that. But what I'm getting at here is the central plot line is it's standard issue. It's nothing special. It's really predictable and not boring. How could it be boring with all those explosions? But it could be. But what actually carries the film here are more the incidentals. It's the embroidery, if you will, of all these characters, all these incidents, all this business. So it's a very busy film, but at heart, the central storyline's not much.
It's an expensive party.
Yes.
So you want to at least go and have some champagne.
Yes.
Now, actually, even though Brie Larson is Captain Marvel in this movie, she did this movie first and then did her role for Captain Marvel. So she did it out of order, which is our segue into anything you want to add about overlap between this movie and Captain Marvel.
Well,
I have to say I'm a little disappointed that the cat didn't appear because I really thought the cat was awesome.
Well, since I'm functioning as a financial reporter today, I'll follow through on that. I mean, the fact that, you know, Avengers is, you know, the biggest deal ever, if you will. But as we speak, Captain Marvel was still playing in movie theaters 8 weeks after it was released. And even though Avengers was way on top with all that money it made opening weekend, the number two picture, as we speak, is Captain Marvel. Mm-hmm. It made $8 million, which for a film that's been out that long is a lot. So I think Brie Larson is a very happy actor right now. I mean, to be, and also, quite seriously, you know, when we talk about the dominance of superhero movies, here we go. It's literally like a 1-2 punch. Whoever didn't go to see Avengers because they couldn't get in went to see Captain Marvel or see it again. This is something else with the phenomenon, that even when you can stream things, there's still something about seeing a movie and then going back again. There's something ritualistic, cult-like. And I'm actually happy that that hasn't gone away, that people will leave the house.
I think the reason that movie's done really well also is because at the end of Infinity Wars, we saw that Captain Marvel was going to be maybe the one to save everybody. So it was a good tie-in, like lead-in to the final movie that now you get to see what she is, who she is, and then you see her in Endgame as well.
It's very smart marketing.
How would you compare Hellboy to
well,
what we've just discussed?
Well, it's in the running for worst movies of the year. It's what not to do in a superhero movie or any movie at all. It's so overloaded with special effects that nothing's special after a while, and it's just total nonsense. You have the story taking place. Well, first of all, it's rebooting something that Guillermo del Toro had done much better in 2004 and 2008. He's gone from it now, creative differences, as they say. And with the actors, likewise, Ron Perlman, who really did own that Hellboy character, he's gone too. So the new guy, David Harbour, fills the outfit, but not much more than that. And the new director, Neil Marshall, just oversees the chaos. There's very little structure or sense to the whole thing. And it's a shame because Marshall directed one of the best horror films of the 21st century, The Descent from 2006. But here, it's a total mess. Speaking of a mess, one reason is you look at the script or whatever they're working with, and it's taking place in multiple countries. It's taking place over 16 centuries. You've got witches and fairies and Nazis and Arthurian legends, including Excalibur. It's speaking of tossing in everything, everything's tossed in. And by the time you get Mila Jovovich as a sorceress, I'm thinking, well, why not?
Why not?
Anything goes here. Nothing matters.
You know, he almost also looks like the less attractive sibling of Thanos.
Yes, exactly. And in terms of the total mess that this movie is, one of the reviews of it really nailed it in terms of what this director's up against here. And the quote is this. This critic said that Neil Marshall directs Hellboy, quote, like a dog at a squirrel convention.
Oh, that's really on point. A dog at a squirrel convention. All right, that's Hellboy for you. And that's all of our time for today. So join us next time.
I'll see you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.